ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
What if living offline isn't a choice anymore? I'm Rae Johnston, and in Opt Out, I'm finding out just how much of our lives are online and whether we can ever really unplug. From privacy experts to hackers, we explore what it means to disappear in a world that's always watching. Opt Out. To hear it, search for Download This Show wherever you get your podcasts or hear it on the ABC Listen app.
Hello, Natasha Mitchell with Big Ideas on ABC Radio National Summer, and this is where I love bringing you our and your favourite episodes from the year, so why not take Big Ideas on your holiday road trips? If you were a kid who hid behind the couch from the Daleks, then this is an episode for you. Tom Baker, I Will Have No Argument, will always be my Doctor Who. Yours might go back as far as John Pertwee or be as recent as David Tennant or Jodie Whittaker or the wonderful Nushuti Gatwa from the hit series Sex Education. For six decades, the Doctor has proved this unlikely folk hero and with the most loyal fan scene in the Whovians. Doctor Who has taken us on all sorts of existential adventures on screen, but look, off screen, this time traveller's story has just been extraordinary as well, with failed monks and war heroes and polyamory and self-sabotaging broadcasting executives. So jump into the TARDIS today with journalist and cultural historian John Higgs. He is author of Exterminate, Regenerate, The Story of Doctor Who. We are joining him at the York Festival of Ideas in the UK.
Thanks very much. Hello. I'm the author of a book on 60 years of a fiction. And I guess there was one incident in particular that made me think, hey, there's something quite interesting about this character. Not just as of itself, but how it's evolved and changed and fitted into our society and affected people and sort of behaved in a way that other fictional characters don't. And that incident was about in 2007 when I used to work making preschool animation, sort of cheap little milkshake cartoons for Channel 5, which was fun, you know, which is a fun job. And you'd hire some actors. And being me, I'm obviously going to try and hire Tom Baker. And by a wonderful fluke of circumstances, it just so happened that he'd been living in France and was bored to tears. And he'd arranged with his wife that, yes, they can move back to England on proviso that he gets out the house a lot. So we could afford him. For that reason, we could afford him. And I did. He was a narrator for about 65 episodes of this program called The Beeps, and would record his lines. And then, being Tom, we'd go to a pub in Soho, and we were at a place called the Yorkshire Grey, and the bar was sort of goes around a corner. So I'm standing with Tom Baker at this bar, and I'm just in the perfect position to see a guy who was sort of stood by the bar over there. So we had a pint of lager, and it was a Wednesday afternoon, and it was like the most mundane sort of Wednesday that you can sort of imagine. And I was just happened to see him at the exact moment that he looked up and turned his phone off. At the exact moment he looked up and saw Tom Baker was in the pub. And the thing that crossed over his face at that moment, I'm still slightly haunted by, really. I still think about it to this day. It wasn't just a look of, you know, he wasn't just pleased to see him. He wasn't so surprised. It wasn't like, oh, there's that guy who used to be on the telly in the 1970s. It was a look of genuine awe. And it's not until you see a look of genuine awe that you realise there's not a lot of awe about. You know, it was kind of as if that mundane Wednesday had just fallen away and he'd like stepped into Narnia and his world had changed. And I thought, wow, character, if a fictional character can do that to someone, then they kind of matter. You know, we could do it a lot more of that sort of thing in our lives. You know, in our lives we have, you know, our friends, and we have our family, and we have our work colleagues, and we also have fictional characters. You know, and they're not real, but they're not nothing, are they? Especially ones that are in our lives for decades. Especially ones that sort of bring the family together in a cross-generational way, in a way that very few things do these days. You know, the notion of things that are shared with your children or your grandparents, and the kids actually coming out of the bedroom and their screens to sort of join in this sort of family storytelling. It's very, very rare. And I started to realise that because Doctor Who's kind of, well, it's always there. It's always around, isn't it? It's a very easy thing to take for granted. But I think it's a lot more extraordinary than we generally give it credit for. And I think one reason for that, Ian Fleming with James Bond, this is kind of how we imagine fictional characters are created, especially ones that impact on the culture, you know, big, important things that hit a nerve and are talked about for generations. You know, we think there's an Ian Fleming or a J.K. Rowling or an Arthur Conan Doyle. There's like this brilliant genius creator who defines, you know, exactly what that character is, but at the same time defines exactly what they're not, you know. And so people who come along afterwards, like when people write James Bond books now, they always talk about, you know, going back to Fleming, and like Fleming's books have a certain status that, you know, other later writers don't have. That didn't happen with Doctor Who. There was no single creator. It just kind of emerged out of a series of memos and meetings and a sort of a need to fill a scheduling hole, the need to find something to go between Grandstand, which the dads watched, and Jukebox Jury, which the kids watched. I had to find something to fit into that. So it wasn't the thing that just sort of emerged out of, in a moment of inspiration, and someone saw this sort of wonderful character. It was much more a sort of a problem to be solved. If you look at the early memos, yeah, at the top they talk about the handsome young man hero. That's the first character. That would be a character called Ian. And then there's a handsome, well-dressed heroine. And that was a second character. That's the character who became Barbara. And that was the core of the series. And then, not so much as an afterthought, it's just this odd thing. It's like the maturer man, 35 to 40. With some character twist. That's not a character design, is it? That's a desire for a character. It's like a space where a character could be. And because no one really defined what it was, and no one really defined what it wasn't, people being able to sort of pass it around from writer to writer to showrunner, and they've all just gone, I'm just going to make this my own. I'm just going to completely own it. I'm just going to do what I want with this in a way that you can't do with a lot of other characters. So it's the way it's sort of changed over time is unusual, and it's very odd. And, you know, I think it's a trickster, basically. If you're looking to try to define what the character is, here's a few tricksters from sort of history. A trickster is, well, obviously they're playful and mischievous. They often, they like disguises. They can change their appearance. They can change their gender. They often steal like a magical thing from the gods, you know, or a time machine from the Time Lords. And they're boundary dwellers. They cross boundaries that normal people can't cross, like the boundaries of, you know, time and space. And they basically descend from the heavens to our world, upturn it, and clear off, right? That's the sort of behaviour of a trickster. But they're not goodies. They're not good guys. They're just a force for change. They don't really care whether it's for good or bad. Except when they're on TV, a weird little thing happens, like Marvel's version of Loki. And, you know, in the films, he's a trickster. You know, he's not really a goody, but he's not really a baddie. He's just this strange, you know, other thing. The moment they put him into his own TV series, he's like trying to save his friends and just acting for the greater good, you know, and things like that the tricksters don't really do. Bugs Bunny is another great example. In a small cartoon, they're absolutely this trickster spirit. But you put them in a longer thing like Space Jam, and they're behaving like a regular protagonist, and it's quite odd. And the thing is, it's because they love disguises. Like, they can't change. It's impossible for a trickster to become something else. A trickster's always a trickster, but they can disguise themselves. They can put on the mask of a hero, if that's going to work in that circumstances. But underneath the mask, right, there's something a lot more tricksy is under there. And you see it a lot in Doctor Who, usually after a regeneration, after a change. And if you think about what happened in 1966, it's a good example of that, because what happened was kind of weird, was kind of odd. Obviously, the series started in 63 with William Hartnell, the first Doctor, and the character, as I say, wasn't really that well defined, but Hartnell was a very mercurial, changeable sort of character. And if you look into his history, his, you know, his childhood was such a almost Dickensian, you know, story of neglect and things that you can quite understand why he was like he was. In later life, he was spiky. He could be spiky, he could be scary, but at the same time, he could just turn and be sweet and lovely. And that changeable, mercurial aspect of William Hartnell, he sort of gave to this character. And it's sort of been there ever since. It's outlived Hartnell. It's become almost immortal, really, surviving in the heart of this character. And he loved it. He loved being Doctor Who. One of my favourite stories of him is about... he was in his car and the traffic was stopped, and there was a traffic cop just up ahead sort of stopping the traffic, and he got out of his car and he marched up to the cop and he goes, "Don't you know who I am? I'm Doctor Who. I'm Doctor Bloody Who." And he was Doctor Bloody Who, and he sort of always will be, and he wanted to always be it, because he'd finally found a role in life that it sort of connected him to his inner child again. It sort of made him happy in a way he hadn't been for that so long. But alas, you know, life being what it is, issues of ill health in particular, meant that the BBC made this decision to recast, to get rid of Hartnell, who wanted to do it forever. And if they stayed, we wouldn't be talking about Doctor Who now. The fact that they recast is what made this thing live for decades and decades and decades. But it was an odd way they went about it, because normally, if you're recasting a TV show, it happens a fair bit, you get an actor who's, you know, a bit like the original actor, and they do their take on the same character. That's how it normally works. What they don't do is go, well, we'll just get someone who's like completely different, and they can do it being completely different, but we'll just say they're the same person, you know. That's a really odd choice, and I think a lot of it to do was the pace of change in the 1960s was, you know, extraordinary. The notion that, you know, a lead actor could have his hair as long as that would have been unthinkable in 1963. But then in 1966, it would have been unthinkable to have this sort of patriarchal sort of authority figure as the lead thing. You know, the Beatles mop top was a sense that they were changing to sort of fit in with the world as the world was changing. And change is kind of at the heart of Patrick Troughton, really. One thing people might know about him is his personal life was, I think, unorthodox is probably the word we're sort of looking for. He basically had, he had two partners and two sets of children in two houses in two parts of London and kept it secret while he was Doctor Who. The press behaved very differently in those days. You know? It was secret to the extent that every Christmas he'd go to his mother's with his first wife and their children, and, you know, they'd all act like nothing unusual had happened. And his mum, you know, died not knowing she had all these other grandchildren. It was sort of kept that secret. And that was only part of the complicated web of, you know, girlfriends and emotional and romantic relationships that made up Patrick Troughton's life. And his son, from his first wife, Michael Troughton, the fine actor, very fine actor, he didn't see a lot of his dad growing up, but he did get to go on holiday with him, which he writes about in his book about his dad. And he got to ask his dad, why? Why do you behave like this? And Patrick Troughton just looked at him and said, I need change. Like, things have to change all the time for me, I'm afraid. That's just the way I am. You know, I'm sorry if I hurt you. This utter horror of, like, stasis and life remaining the same was the part of Troughton that he then imprinted on this character, on this fictional character, that's, again, remained there always to this day. And to the extent on his first episode, Power of the Daleks, he says to his companion, Polly, you know, life depends on change and renewal. And that's Troughton just imprinting himself on this character. And this is the pattern that sort of continues. When we say changes, it kind of does and it doesn't. By the time you get to, you know, the 1970s, and it goes into colour, every single thing about the original format, including, you know, its most unique selling point, you know, the idea that they can go anywhere in time and space, right? Everything about it had gone. It had been binned. It was now stuck on Earth. It was exiled to Earth. And Verity Lambert, you know, the first producer of Doctor Who, she just couldn't believe it. You know, for her, the character was like working for the establishment. And yet it was still the same. Yet it's still the same thing. And it's kind of odd. And it kind of helps, I think, if you think about yourself. You know, when you were a child, when you were younger, obviously you looked different. You were a different height, you were a different weight, you had a different haircut. You would have different, you know, opinions, different beliefs, different prejudices, different ideas. You know, even physically the same thing. You know, every cell that made up your sort of younger self has died and, you know, been replaced, you know, probably countless times, you know. It's very hard to say materially why that thing, that child, is the same as that adult. And I think it's because our identity, our sense of self, is really a story. We're a story. And that was the beginning of the story. So yes, of course we're that. We're the same story as that child. We're the same sort of continuation. And with Doctor Who, this was the same continuation of how it started. And because our minds love story. We're kind of like story addicts, really. We say we're not, but we kind of are. If we get, you know, we get home from work and we've got some precious free time, you know, we go, we're probably going to go on Netflix or go in a box set or sort of read a book or watch a film. Or even when you're scrolling through social media, you're sort of, you know, you're following events to what happened to certain characters. You know, we're getting a storytelling fix. We're sort of eager for a storytelling fix. And, you know, religions are kind of, the stories, political parties are stories, you know, a 90-minute game of football is often a better story than a prize-winning novel, you know. What our brains do is that when they're confronted by the vast, chaotic, bewildering, you know, excess of everything, they just go, I'm just going to cut that down and say these things are important, those things aren't important, and I'm going to turn it into a narrative and turn it into a story. So we're kind of addicts. And suddenly you've got this wonderful storytelling, you know, machine that keeps coming up with story after story after story. And it's, you know, in a couple of episodes ago, you know, the programme finally identified itself for the first time as a never-ending story, you know, which it is, it absolutely is. And it's all because of the one thing that never changes.
And what is the thing that never changes? That iconic blue telephone box, the TARDIS. Natasha Mitchell bringing you British author John Higgs on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas today. He's giving us the inside goss about Doctor Who across the ages. John Higgs says Doctor Who is unlike any other fictional character.
I said earlier that everything changes, but there was one fixed thing, which is the exterior of the police box. Only the most minor changes over the decades. You know, it's always instantly sort of recognisable. Because those doors, those are the doors to the other world. They're the doors to everywhere. Those are the doors you step to go through and find another story. And it's a key part. If you look at British myth and Irish myth as well, and Japanese, but not in a lot of places, not of other places, so much of our storytelling, our mythic storytelling, is based around this concept of the other world, which is another place that you can just sort of fall into by, you know, stepping through the, you know, the wardrobe into Narnia, or going down the rabbit hole into Wonderland, or getting to platform 9 3/4, or the mist's part in its Brigadoon, and, you know, and you find this world that's just wonderful, that's exciting. It's sort of thrilling, but it's only as you slowly, as you're there, you slowly realise there's a darkness there as well. The darkness will slowly sort of reveal itself. And time is funny, you know. If you go there for a day, you can come back and you've been gone for a year. And it keeps reappearing in our storytelling, from Tir nan Og in the Irish myths to Avalon, the land of the apple trees, and to Wonderland, it's in A Midsummer Night's Dream. We just keep repeating it. It's not, our myths aren't like origin myths like the Greeks, or end of time myths like Ragnarok with the Norse. Our myths are always just, could be around at any particular point. We could just fall into them. So we keep renewing them, keep recreating them. And so when Britain entered the TV age, of course there was going to be, you know, a portal to the other world there. And it's not the underworld, which is the land of the dead, which is where most countries' myths are. It's the other world. It's the land of the ever young. It's this sort of glorious sort of storytelling opportunity. And it's not like like this wardrobe which just takes you to Narnia, or that rabbit hole that just takes you to Wonderland. It takes you to everywhere and anywhere. And as a result, it's produced so much. So many stories over the years. We've had, it's probably about 890 episodes by now, 890 something, and there's been well over, you know, 1,000 audio adventures on, you know, Big Finish, and then you've got all the comics, and then you've got all the books, and then you've got the BBC audios, and there's been plays, and there's been video games. It's just this absolute tsunami of adventure, of fiction, of narrative, far in excess of anything that any, you know, TV-created character has produced. I don't think there's anyone alive who could have experienced every single official Doctor Who story. And this is before you get to the unofficial ones. This is before you get to the world of fan fiction, you know, and all the fanzines and all that sort of stuff. It's got so much. It's become so big. I've started to wonder if the word fiction isn't quite right, and maybe we need a name like megafiction to describe it, because it's behaving in a way that stories normally don't. And there's often a thing that scale or complexity affects the fundamental nature of something in a sudden phase shift, where, you know, something is easily understandable and behaves itself, and then it reaches a sort of point in size and suddenly it's different. And, you know, hydrogen is obviously a good example. It's just an odorless, colorless gas. Unless you get so much of it together, then suddenly there's a phase shift and it's like this blazing star, you know. And the mud in the ground it's just matter, it's just earth. Until it gets a certain level of complexity, then you've got life there, you know. And life reaches a certain level of complexity and it becomes aware, it becomes conscious, it has an imagination. An imagination, once it reaches a certain level of complexity, it starts creating these fictional characters. And you start to wonder, well, what happens to fictional characters when they get sufficiently complex, when they reach a certain scale? And I think this is why Doctor Who, as I say, doesn't quite behave like a nice little fiction should, right? A good example of this was when it was coming to the end of the Jodie Whittaker years, a few years ago. And there's a lot of talk about, well, you know, this is probably the end of it. It's also problematic for the BBC because of charter changes. They were no longer allowed to make it themselves. They had to put their internally created things out to tender to private companies. And they could sort of fudge it with a company called BBC Studios, which was, you know, technically not them. But really, they were expected by the government to give it to a private company, you know. And for a fiction, for a TV programme, for a character, they need writers, and they need actors, and they need a company to sort of make it. And most fictions would just sort of passively sort of sit back in the hope that these things turn up. But what Doctor Who did was kind of odd, because suddenly there was the writer, Russell T. Davies, came back. Suddenly there was the actor, there was David Tennant, he came back. But both of those were a writer or an actor because the programme had made them one in the first place. You know, David Tennant was three when he saw John Pertwee turn into Tom Baker, and it blew his mind, and he had to speak to his parents about it, and he learned at that point about the existence of things called actors, and at that point he knew what he, you know, wanted to be. He always says that Doctor Who made him an actor, and Russell T. Davies will always talk about how Doctor Who made him a writer. You know, a lot of writers say the same. Stephen Moffat will say exactly the same sort of thing. But it went further than that. Remember, in the Christopher Eccleston series, there was this TV company in the future called Bad Wolf. And Billy Piper's character sort of inhaled the time vortex, and she took the name of this company, Bad Wolf, and she scattered it throughout time and space, leaving a trail that paradoxically led her back to where she was, all that sort of stuff. It was just a thing that exists in fiction. A TV company exists in fiction. But a decade later, the executives behind this series, Jane Tranter, Julie Gardner, they set up their own company, and they decided that no, they'd manifest Bad Wolf. They'd make it exist in the real world. So they set up Bad Wolf. And so you reach the point where this programme needs a non-BBC company to make it. And it's made one. It's created one itself. And it, you know, it's set in Cardiff where the skill set is and everything. So it created the company, and it created the actor, and it created the writer that it needed to survive. This is very advanced things, evolutionary speaking. It's called niche creation, evolutionary speaking. It's the idea isn't that, you know, a species will just go into a territory and, you know, find everything they need to flourish. What happens is a species will go into a territory and it will start acting in that territory. And by doing so, it will change things, and it will change the world to make it suitable for itself to survive, right? This is kind of advanced stuff for a story to be doing. In theory, it's only living things can do this, right? And that sort of makes sense. But if you look at what the definition of a living thing is, it's not very clear cut, and there's lots of arguments about it. It's obvious sort of things. A thing needs to sort of move and grow and change and consume and survive and things like that. It never usually says, oh yeah, and they also, you know, have to exist. They have to be real, you know. I think they assume that. I think that's sort of taken for read. It can sound very weird saying that, like, a story, like a character, like Doctor Who, is behaving in the way that a living thing does. It's very weird to say that a fiction is alive, you know. It's much better to say it just behaves as if it is alive, right, which it sort of does. That always sounds a lot better, unless you try and work out what the difference is between something that's alive and something that just acts like it's alive. That's always a tricky one. That's always a problematic one. So this series, it's sort of created around it this sort of network of relationships, this sort of Whovian industrial complex built up of fans that have been inspired by it, who have set up audio companies or magazines or conventions or the whole sort of world that sort of envelops it and sort of kind of protects it and sort of helps it sort of live and survive and protect it from attacks from people like Michael Grade, or, you know, the sort of attacks it's getting now is a good example. Because now it's a very, very tricky time. You know, for a TV series to keep going, it has to adapt to the changing culture and the changing entertainment ecosystem. These are all very, very choppy waters at the moment. You've probably seen a lot of reports in the media about this absolute, you know, crisis in British drama, where because, you know, ratings of everything have just collapsed and costs have just skyrocketed up, a British story, a British drama, just cannot get made now unless it also appeals overseas, unless it appeals to the Americans or something like that, or put in enough money to get it made. Things like the thing about the post office, the ITV series about the post office, would not get made now because it has no international sort of... It's an absolute massive crisis, and the industry is absolutely freaked out. But for Doctor Who, you might think, well, that's, you know, that's going to be watched overseas, so it might be all right, you know. But it's not... It's never mainstream anywhere else. It's always just this sort of cult thing. I think it's just basically a bit too mad for the rest of the world. They like things like Paddington, right? That works internationally. And there's something about that sort of, you know, polite reasonableness that you get in Paddington that they sort of want from England in particular. But it's not us, is it? We're not. It's part of us. That's an aspect of who we are. But who we are really is, I think, a lot more wilder and a lot more crazier than you'd expect from, you know, Downton Abbey or, you know, Paddington or something like that. I think it's because, as I say, this character didn't have a single creator. You've just had dozens and dozens of actors and writers and directors coming and sort of imprinting themselves on it, giving parts of themselves to this character, you know, sometimes giving too much and they're never quite the same, you know, again. And so it's become this sort of crowd-sourced archetype, this fiction that's parts of so many other people that it can't help but get a sort of a wider sort of imprint of this island, of the people on this island. It's a tricky one for internationals. Yeah, and this is before you get to the whole cultural changes at the moment, because anyone remember when Kemi Badenoch announced she was going to stand for leader of the Conservative Party? She put out this video on social media to announce that she was standing. And in the video, her argument for why she should be leader of the Conservative Party was, "I'm not afraid of Doctor Who." And it was just that. It wasn't like, oh, here's my economic policies and here's my thoughts on foreign affairs. Oh, and by the way, I'm not afraid of Doctor Who. It was just, "I'm not afraid of Doctor Who," by which she meant David Tennant, who, as a parent of a trans child, had criticised her. So she was, in her head, she was fighting back against this. And if you watch Doctor Who, it's kind of hard to hear someone say, "I'm not afraid of Doctor Who," without seeing them as some, like, evil supervillain whose plans are going to fall horribly wrong in about half an hour's time. But she knew she wasn't talking to people who watched Doctor Who. She was talking specifically to the voting members of the Conservative Party. And she knew they wouldn't have any truck with this nonsense, you know, this ridiculous sort of thing. There was some lovely data in the Rest is Entertainment podcast a while back, which looked at how people voted to what their favourite TV shows were. And the people who viewed themselves as progressive, they had Doctor Who as one of their absolute favourite programme. You know, I think it was that and Blue Planet. People on the right, you know, they just didn't watch it anymore. They just thought it's not for them. You know, the attitudes or something were... they just didn't get it. They just didn't like it. It was silly, but it was... I mean, you can see the press that this thing is getting. S series has had the most negative sort of media narrative around it that I can remember of any sort of series of Doctor Who, at a time when, to my eyes, it's phenomenal. It's like been a phenomenal season for me. At least that's how I've sort of enjoyed it. And the disconnect between what it is and the media reaction to it is kind of extraordinary. And this is the Sun in February saying that Shuti Gatra had quit. That was their story, Shuti Gatra had quit. If you saw the Sun a week ago, their front page headline was Shuti Gatra was being sacked, right? Can't both be true. At least one must have been made up. It's the Sun really hates Shuti Gatra. I don't know what it is about the first black gay Doctor Who that they don't like. You'd have to ask them. It's probably the moustache, I don't know. But this really frightening sort of narrative that, it's doomed, the series is doomed, it's sort of coming to an end, has been all around it, you know, in these past few months. But there's a funny thing with Doctor Who. As I say, this guy's a trickster. They're a boundary dweller. They cross through boundaries that they aren't supposed to. And that's certainly been what's been happening in the fiction of it since the Toymaker sort of turned up and it started behaving like to the rules of play rather than the rules of narrative. The boundary between what's been on the screen, the story, and the whole world of Doctor Who beyond it has just been absolutely broken like nobody's business. It's even the trailers, they were just wandering into the wrong, you know, TV show. They were there, they were in the Traitors, you know, and then you get episodes like Lux where the animations are coming out of the screen, and then the Doctor and Belinda, they sort of come out of the telly to sort of meet some viewers. And the fourth wall's so gone, you know. The Doctor would sort of look at the camera and wink and go into a song and dance routine, you know. That guy knows they're on a TV show, you know. Mrs. Flood knows she's on a TV show. She delivers these monologues. She even started to talk about, like, oh, well, the series is coming to an end. It was like limited run, few weeks only. It's like, how is the narrative of this whole thing sort of fallen out like that? And it's got to this sort of bizarre stage. I kind of think with Russell T. Davis is he knows the impact that representation, right, has on the wider society. He knows this from doing Queer as Folk back in the 90s. I don't know if you know that series, very groundbreaking series. But it was just after, you know, in the 80s, there was Clause 28 and people were just being openly homophobic in the Houses of Parliament. And at that point, in that late 80s, if you'd have said, well, when that party gets back into power, they're going to legalise gay marriage, no one would have taken that remote. It was just ridiculous. It was just insane, that idea. And yet that's kind of exactly what happened. You know, culture changes, society sort of changes. And part of that was spearheaded by Russell T. Davis, just putting gay characters on TV, behaving like gay characters, and people at home just going, oh, it's just some people. You know, it's not really a problem. It very much impacts that. So when he's putting, you know, a trans character on BBC One on a Saturday in a happy family, right, he knows that's not normal for TV. You don't normally see that on TV. So he knows what he's doing that. So he's very much sort of pushing that sort of thing. I think for Russell T. Davis, the Doctor is something that fights the monsters both on screen and off. You know, I think he sees it as an active force for sort of societal change, you know. And it's and when you look back at this series and look back at this sort of narrative that, oh, this is the end. The Doctor Who, Doctor's doomed, right? How could they survive what's happening in the world of BBC, in the world of Disney and all that sort of stuff? You just think, hang on, this is just the cliffhanger, isn't it? I said, the cliffhangers just sort of spilt out into the real world. Of course they're going to survive. They always survive, you know. The question is how, and that question of how they survive is what gets you sort of mind racing. Because as a child, it would be those cliffhangers that, you know, that made you think about the programme when it wasn't on. For a lot of people, it made them into writers because they started thinking like a writer. They go, well, I know he's going to survive, but how? And they'd sort of try and work it out. They'd come up with something and it might even be better than what actually happened. And that was always, you know, very exciting. That sense that the programme then became something that you thought about outside of when it's on. And then when you started doing that, it kind of became part of your identity. It kind of imprinted on you a little bit. It's like, you know, sports fandom. They always talk about their team as we, you know. They'll never say they lost. It's like we lost, you know. They identify with the team. Like, they and the team are pretty much the same sort of thing. Doctor Who can do that to you. And especially if you reach a point where it's not for you, and normally you just sort of drift off, you know, like it's easy to drift off long-running programmes like EastEnders or Have I Got News to You, you just sort of drift away. It's hard to do that with Doctor Who. You kind of feel the need to sort of keep sort of going back to it. And it means that when a new episode's coming up, for a lot of fans, a lot of the audience, they kind of approach it, not with like, oh, excitement, there's a new episode coming, but like an anxiety that like, oh, no, please don't embarrass me, please don't sort of... Because when the thing that's become part of you is this sort of like, you know, half-mad sort of children's programme made on an unhelpful budget by a lot of people who are quite mad, there's a great amount of possibility that it can all go, you know, horribly wrong and be embarrassing. So that's often the first watch. It's then, after the watch, you're safe and you can go back and see all the good things, and then you start to sort of appreciate it, and then you sort of enjoy it. That sense that, I guess it's part of you, because it sort of matters, and maybe part of your family and part of these things. It means more than a fictional character kind of should. And I kind of think the reason it works at Christmas is basically it's a gift, really. Like, it shouldn't exist. Yeah, if you look at the 60 years of history, it's not logical. It's not even likely. It's barely sort of plausible. These things, it shouldn't have, you know, come like this. And yet it has. And yet we have it. And we have it in our lives, you know. And as I say, it's very easy to take for granted because it's always there. And it's not crying out as being something that's important that needs, you know, academic attention or critical appraisal or you know, something. It's serious people, it's too mad for them, you know. It sort of keeps them away, which is great, you know, which is really good for it. And so it just sort of goes under the radar. It's always there and it's very easy to overlook. But when you step, which is what I hope this book sort of does, when you sort of step back and you see this sort of, it was like a space for a character, and this character just sort of appeared there, and in the gap between many minds, many different people sort of produced this thing that sort of went on to have its sort of own agency, to become this almost evolutionary perfect storytelling machine that survives in a way that our greatest writers, you know, can't create characters that do that, you know. It's phenomenal. It's a phenomenal thing to happen. I think we're just very, very lucky to sort of have it in our lives.
Aren't we? The wild and wonderful world of Doctor Who on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas today. I'm Natasha Mitchell. John Higgs is the author of Exterminate, Regenerate, The Story of Doctor Who. And I wonder if you're part of the enormous and passionate, very dedicated fan community of Whovians. At the York Festival of Ideas in the UK, John is now in conversation with a very thrilled audience of, I imagine, a fair few Whovians.
I'm just interested in that story about Patrick Troughton and how he had two families. I just wonder, were his families aware of each other?
He was very open to people. He was very sort of emotionally sort of open to people about this. Now, you know, there'd be a name for it. You know, now we'd say, oh, he was like polyamorous or like a sex addict or whatever it would be. Then, no one could believe that this sort of thing was going on. So it wasn't that he hid it from the people he was close to. He was always very open to them and very honest to them. And you never get any reports of him making him sound like predatory or sort of toxic in some way. It's always an awful lot of affection. He hurt a lot of people because he couldn't commit. But there's always an awful lot of affection for him as well. Yeah, it's strange. It's a strange situation. He was a very interesting man, sort of Patrick Troughton. I assume none of the others had a similar life. I didn't find anything else like that about it.
Very interesting. I really like Doctor Who, yeah. You were telling about the origin of Doctor Who. Mm. Well, one of its origins was a series called Quatermass.
Yeah.
You may have heard, there's three series. And it was filmed in Stanley Hope. Some of it was. My mum worked there when they were filming it. And that's where I think where they got Doctor Who from the sort of mysterious, the mist.
So much of Doctor Who comes from Quatermass.
Yes.
And I can see why Nigel Neal, who wrote Quatermass, really had a problem with Doctor Who.
Mm.
He was always very angry about it, or he'd say it was too much for children.
Yeah.
But they ripped off so much of his work. First John Pertwee one was Quatermass 2, essentially. These things fall from sky. He's an integral part of the DNA, even though technically he's not Nigel Neal. Yeah, and it's fascinating the way that when the BBC were creating Doctor Who, they were of the opinion that it was like science fiction was kind of beneath them. They sort of commissioned a bunch of reports to find out what science fiction was and whether they can make TV out of it and stuff. They'd never do that for like a comedy or another type of programme. And yet, Quatermass, British drama on the map, really, especially that first one, Rudolf Cartier, the director and stuff like that, moved drama away from it's basically a play with a camera instead of an audience to sort of what we know now. It was such a big part of the take-up of television and crucial, crucial series. But the BBC, they just sort of looked down on science fiction, and as Nigel Neal sort of found out, someone as talented as him.
I'd be interested to know what your research has revealed about the hiatus between Sylvester McCoy, McCann, and then Russell Davies bringing it back with Christopher.
Yeah, I mean, it's an absolute crucial and fascinating period because you've got sort of... It's a slow 16-year change where people who love the programme at the BBC, who are just starting out, their careers are slowly starting to rise. Like someone like Jane Tranter, who is now an executive producer of HBO's Succession, big sort of thing like that. The thing that thrilled her most was in the Sylvester McCoy years, he got the job of marking up the rehearsal studio. So she'd come in at the weekend by herself, crawling around on this dusty floor, marking out where the TARDIS was, She was delighted by this. She absolutely loved it. And obviously, Russell T. Davies was sort of starting out at this point. So slowly, those people are gaining power and prestige and experience in the industry. And at the same time, the culture of the BBC that was the result of Michael Grade coming in that hated the programme. I mean, really hated it. I mean, where before Michael Grade came over to the BBC when I think it was an ITC, was he? He'd given interviews slagging off the BBC, and he singled out Doctor Who and Come Dancing, right, as the sort of deadwood that the BBC had to get rid of, right? These are obviously the crown jewels of the 21st century BBC. It's a clear, he wasn't a man for spotting potential. For seeing, hey, if this thing had the right people and the right money and the right attention, this could be amazing. He didn't sort of see that. He sort of came in thinking, kind of like a Roman emperor. It's his job to say yes or no to what should be on the BBC. And when you have a hierarchical organisation like the BBC, the prejudices of the person on top very quickly sort of spread to the people below them, usually in exaggerated ways. And so come the mid-1980s, the BBC just hated it. It just hated it. They would put programmes on about how terrible it was. They would talk about how poor the people making it were, like in radio interviews and stuff like that, in a way you can possibly imagine now. So it took that to sort of fall out of the BBC, those attitudes to fall away, the rise of those other people. And at the same time, the imaginative side of it all in the Virgin New Adventures books and things like that, and Paul McGann sort of stuff, was sort of showing, hey, this could be all sorts of other things, and all that sort of bubbling up. So it's a way that, as I say, this character survives in a way it sort of shouldn't. It sort of stepped out of the TV into these books and continued sort of living and living until it got a point to get back on screen. Yeah, it's the Wilderness Years is fascinating time of it, yeah.
Well, first of all, I thought it was really interesting. I guess this is more an observation rather than a question. But I guess it feels at the moment, particularly with all the attacks from much of the right-wing press, as if Doctor Who is almost a similar moment to what we had at the end of the classic series. It's been almost predetermined that it's going to decline, or it is in decline. And I think it almost obscures the fact that Doctor Who has always had a very quite overt political element. You have to go back to the 70s with episodes like The Green Death, discussions on the, you know, the UK joining the EEC and, you know, kind of discussions on colonialism and so forth. So I think a lot of those kind of framings you get in much of the, you know, the Daily Mail and so forth, they don't really actually pay attention to what the history of Doctor Who actually is.
Yeah.
And it's more just a kind of anti, you know, woke standing point that it can, you know, take essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Doctor Who's been anti-fascist since 1963, since that speech, was it January 64 maybe? It was the episode of The Daleks where Ian sort of lectures the Tholes on how pacifism is no use in front of fascism. You just have to fight fascism, basically. That sort of, that was there right at the start. So it's always sort of been there. And as I say, it's, although it does change, it's more that it sort of accumulates, it sort of grows, it becomes more complex. Once ideas are in there, they very rarely sort of fall out. It does make sense that it has this sort of celebration of diversity and things like that. So when the country, or the world really, when the world's in the sort of state that it is with, particularly in America, particularly with the Trump administration and how they're sort of behaving, the temptation might be to retreat from that. But that's not what Doctor Who is. Doctor Who has these values. So now, as much as I'd love it to be for everyone, you know, it feels a shame that some people, it's not for me. It does feel a shame. But in the Trump era, of course it should be standing up for those values. That's at the heart of it. It would not be Doctor Who if it wasn't sort of doing that sort of thing. And because it's doing it, it sort of sheds light on all the other things that aren't, you know, all the other things that are acquiescing. So it's, yeah, it's impact in the culture and stuff like that is very important.
What's your favourite episode?
Do you know Pyramids of Mars? It's probably because it's the first one I can remember. But there was something about the atmosphere. I mean, it was spooky. It was very, very spooky. I was too young. It blew my mind. And even though it's oddly unfunny for that era, Tom Baker, there's no humour in it at all, it still just takes me back. I just absolutely love that episode. But more recently, The 11th Hour has got to be up there. Day of the Doctor was kind of special as well, yeah. We're not spoilt for good ones, basically. We've got many options, yes.
Do you think you have to watch all of the Doctors to enjoy Doctor Who?
No. You don't have to, but if you do... there comes a point in your life when you go, I should do the marathon, shouldn't I? I should start at An Unearthly Child, 1963. And it's going to take so many years, and you watch it all. And everyone I know who's done it is like, I'm so glad I did that. You just sort of see, not the series change, but the country change, the world change. It's phenomenal to see the programme in that light, in this sort of constant sort of thing. So I'd heartily recommend it. And I'd heartily recommend it happening. But the thing is, ain't no rules with this sort of thing, you know. You just do what you enjoy. You don't feel pressured into, oh, I've got to see a black and white one or anything like that if it's not for you. Just watch what you like. But at some point, that thought might cross your mind. Thank you all so much for listening. Bless you. Thank you for coming.
60 years young, Doctor Who, continuing to inspire new generations, now with Rwandan Scottish actor Nshuti Gadwa as the 15th Doctor. John Higgs' book is called Exterminate, Regenerate, the story of Doctor Who. Are you a fan? Let me know. bigideas@abc.net.au. What are your big Doctor Who memories? And thanks to the York Festival of Ideas for today's event. And you can join me at events across Australia. Head to the Big Ideas homepage, scroll on down, look for Be In Our Audience. My name is Natasha Mitchell, back very soon with more Big Ideas.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.